Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump has the habit of suddenly changing his mind. His 50-day ultimatum directed at Russia to end the Ukraine conflict is now up in the air. Why the change is anyone's guess. However, it is fair to assume Trump wants to divert attention from his transparency problems. Crosstalking Trump and Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Daniel Lazar in Washington. He's a journalist and author of three books on the U.S. Constitution. In London, we have Dayinka Makinda. He is an independent academic. And in Serbia, we cross to Drago Bajnic. He is a geopolitical and military analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you first here. Trump is reshuffling the deck again. Maybe we'll get through this program before he does it again. But he's moved from his 50-day ultimatum demanding that Russia end the conflict in Ukraine. Not a very nuanced demand, I must say. Now it's 10 to 12 days. So he announced that on Monday of this week. So the clock is ticking. Why is this? As I suggested in my introduction, he has a lot of transparency problems. I don't want to talk about the Epstein files on this program. It's in the air, but there's a lot of other things going on. He was asked if he would strike Iran again. He didn't deny it. He, in a very casual way, mentioned that people are starving in Gaza. So in total, I have to wonder what he wants and does not want to talk about. Daniel.
No one really quite knows. I mean, trying to penetrate the mind of Donald Trump is no easy business. I think that what Trump really wants to avoid is a repeat of July and August 2021, when Joe Biden saw the collapse of Afghanistan on his watch. And Donald Trump does not want to see the collapse of the Ukraine on his watch. So that's his ultimate nightmare, and he wants to forestall. Now, ending this war is much more difficult than he thought it would be. He thought he'd be able to negotiate a solution in 24 hours, which was, of course, a joke. And Russia now clearly has the edge. And Putin is in no mood to negotiate when he is prevailing on the battlefield. So that's the reality. And Trump doesn't know how to respond.
Adeika, in London, he's threatening secondary sanctions, which, to be clear for everyone, those are sanctions on other countries, not on Russia. So Trump is threatening to blow up the global trade system now. Obviously, these secondary sanctions will be directed at India and China. That's not sending a good look, and that's an understatement. So where is this going here? I mean, is he willing to blow up the global trade environment just to make Putin talk to him again in a sweet way? I mean, make sense of it for us. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, it's fairly difficult to make sense of Trump, not just as a personality, but the fact that people should now realize that American presidents, Trump included, are captives of the national security state. We can deduce all of this from all the position papers and all the think tanks who have actually latched on to the America First. They are like an adaptable hydra. They have names such as the America First Policy Institute and Heritage Foundation. But what they do is that they essentially are making it a continuum of the immediate post-war policy, you know, encapsulated by the likes of Wolfowitz, which is that America will not tolerate a peer competitor. And in that sense, Trump apparently has no alternative other than to worm his way around. But he can't get out of it. He's handcuffed and he's essentially trapped.
Yes, Drago, he's you know, there's a lot of theatrics around Donald Trump. We've all gotten used to it. And for goodness sake, he's been invading our lives for a decade right now. But I think you can make a very strong argument that it's no different from the Biden administration's foreign policy. Again, Ukraine, Russia, Iran, Gaza. There's nuances as far as presentation is concerned. But in substance, there's very little difference.
Well, as both of my predecessors said, Trump seems to be trapped by the let's say the deep state, whatever you want to call it. He has tried to push back to a certain degree, but I think he understands now that he cannot have allies, political allies of any sort in Washington, D.C., without actually succumbing to the pressure of the so-called swamp. So instead of draining the swamp, as he said, it seems he's drowning in it now, and he's going to continue to do so unless he changes his, his associates. And obviously, as I mentioned, it's very difficult, if possible at all, to find people who are, anti-war in Washington, D.C., because it's a major business in the United States, unfortunately. The military-industrial complex has a tremendous amount of influence on the political system. And these people have, and a lot of people who make decisions, actually have the interest to continue the confrontation with Russia, whether that's a low-level confrontation, whether it's a high-intensity, sort of like Cold War-style confrontation. It doesn't matter. As long as it keeps the money flowing, it's good for them.
You know, Daniel, this is very, I like the phrase, he's drowning in the swamp. I think you can all, which I think is valid analysis, but I think you could make the opposite, is that Trump is just embracing the swamp now. I mean, they've welcomed him. Daniel.
Well, when you're elected president of the United States, you're really elected president of U.S. Imperialism, Inc. And so Trump claims to be able to run the U.S. empire better than Joe Biden did. But he finds himself in the same predicament, facing the same problem. And it's just not easy for him to extricate himself. Look, I mean, Ukraine has one-third the population of Russia. It's got about one-tenth or one-eleventh the GDP, and it's got one-third the military budget. So how can it possibly prevail? And Russia is gaining the edge on the battlefield, and that is the big problem facing both Trump and the EU. And no one has an answer. Defeat is no fun. and that's what they're facing in the Ukraine, and no one knows what to do.
And Adeyeka, that's absolutely right. They're managing defeat. They won't say it, but they're managing it. It just like they've managed this entire, what I call the Ukraine project. It's a bunch of narratives and memes. Russia has lost. Russia is losing. Russia's using washing machine parts for its missiles. They're so short of drones, they're getting them from Iran. We've heard this for 3.5 years, this nonsense. They have to come up with a new narrative, don't they, to manage their defeat?
Yes, it's been an exercise in myth-making,
yeah,
and perpetuating of false narratives. What will they pull out next? I mean, I think what they are headed towards, obviously, is they want to freeze the conflict. This is an assumption. The Kremlin does not want a nuclear war to break out. Vladimir Putin has done what he can in a very cautious manner to prevent that. And also, we have to presume, despite the bellicosity coming from various capitals in Paris, London, et cetera, that the Europeans don't want it to descend into that. And so what they want to do is they want to freeze, and they want that freeze so that they can have what you would call a North-South Korea kind of freeze, but more likely they want it to be like Syria, in which once America has achieved this so-called division of labor, which was actually a phrase that Pete Hegseth was actually copying from one of these policy institutes that have overtaken the so-called MAGA America First movement, they can concentrate on China and then hopefully come back to Ukraine, where the blood of ordinary Ukrainians is of absolutely no concern to them. They just want to weaken Russia and hopefully create the circumstances where Russia can crumble and it can be balkanized so that they can have access to Russia's natural resources.
Yeah, Drago, I mean, I've heard this Korea scenario for quite a while right now. It's not going to work in the case of Ukraine, because in the Korean scenario is the Soviet Union, China, the United States, North Korea, and South Korea all agreed. That's why we have this frozen conflict on the peninsula. That's not going to happen in this case. Russia is winning. Why would it want anything like a ceasefire? Go ahead.
Exactly. Well, first of all, Russia is not going to allow any sort of Ukrainian state, whatever is left of it, to join NATO. It's simply not it's not allowed in the context of Russia's strategic security. And no Russian general or president is willing to make such concessions to the political West at the time when the political West is conducting a Barbarossa 2.0, essentially. So what we're going to see is, if it's going to be a frozen conflict, it's not going to be like North and South Korea. It's going to have to be like a sort of like this semi-neutral state that's going to be demilitarized and with a sort of a hybrid government. That's the best that the Ukrainians can get at this point if they decide to stop escalating and to actually start talking to the Russians. If not, then they are up for a total defeat. That's inevitable if they don't start, using diplomacy instead of guns.
Well, I tend to think, as we approach the break here, is that the original 50-day deadline ultimatum, some generals are looking at it and say, Ukraine is not doing very well. Maybe we need to move up the ultimatum. I think that's really very much in play as well. There's a panic going on. It's already been mentioned here, Trump doesn't want another exit from Afghanistan happening in Ukraine. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump and Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelle. To remind you, we're discussing Trump and Ukraine. Okay, before we continue, I'd like to ask all three of you, not at this point in time, but before the end of the program, the following question. Can you trust the man that cheats at golf? But hold that thought, and I want to go back to Daniel here. You know, the real problem here is that the way they have phrased it is that they do not want, they're not working towards a Ukrainian victory. They want to make sure that Ukraine doesn't lose. That is the problem here. Would you agree with that, Daniel?
Well, yes, except that Ukraine's definition of losing is unrealistic. I mean, Ukraine is officially demands the return of all captured territories, all Russian-occupied territories, which includes the Crimea, for example, which would also mean the Russia's surrender of its Sevastopol naval base. This is completely impossible. It's unrealistic. It's like NATO. It's like a Mexico demanding the return of Texas. It's never going to happen, and so therefore, the Ukraine can't possibly win. So its loss, its defeat is foretold. It's inevitable.
Well, let's go back to our guest in London. I mean, let's look at what's going on in Ukraine, and specifically about the condition of the regime in Kiev here. Over the last few days, we've seen these protests as a result of the Zelensky clique shutting down or attempting to shut down these anti-corruption organizations. I want to address this to Adaika in London. I mean, this shows that there is regime decline and regime decay. And I'm very, very suspicious of these young kids showing posters in English. I mean, what's going on here? I mean, this seems like some kind of another colored revolution here. I want to be clear with our viewers. I mean, it's not a massive movement in Ukraine, but the fact that it's happening tells us something that's going on. Go ahead, in London.
Yes, it does smack of stage management. There's quite a great deal for the Ukrainians to complain about since the conflict began, not least the colossal loss of life, which is presently unacknowledged. It's the figures that are coming in, although we don't know for sure, but certainly tallies made from expansions of cemeteries, etc., they show that Ukraine has suffered tremendous human loss of life, as well as the destruction of its military capabilities. And so now that Russia is turning towards this idea of destroying certain forms of infrastructure that have been supporting the war, but which they laid off for a while, I think discontent will surely be materialized. I mean, you can't have that situation of where at these protests, you may have noticed some fairly well turned out young men, nattily dressed. Why are they not on the front lines? They must somehow be, you know, connected to the oligarchs, if not directly sired by them. And so that iniquity also is something which is it's a bubble that is bound to burst. So far, it's been managed. But at some point, this tiresome tale-telling and, you know, Zelensky and his cosplay and his green fatigues, it's all going to become tired. Reality has to hit home. And they have to now make realistic decisions.
All the more so. Many people describe it as a military dictatorship with the lack of freedom of expression, assembly, et cetera, et cetera, and destruction of the church. A lot of people would go along with that if they were winning, but they're not winning. So you have this growing authoritarian state, and you're losing on the battlefield. That's probably the worst possible mix. Would you agree? Back to London.
Oh, absolutely. The military situation is pretty dire. I cannot see how any of them would be optimistic about taking any of the territories that Russia, along with the separatists, have now fused into the Russian Federation. And of course, the Crimea and the Sevastopol naval base. It really is a lost cause. And so all one can foresee is that while Russia continues its methodical destruction of Ukrainian materiel and members of the armed forces, it will be down really to the Ukrainian people to, if it's a real democracy, to assert themselves by this dictator who has been imposed on them.
Yes, and I foresee that once that happens, you'll have a civil war in Ukraine, wanting to know why they lost, where all the money went, and all of the people that took flight after the Zelensky and his crowd took flight to Miami, for example. Drago, let me go to you. I mean, Bloomberg has recently reported the U.S. has likely deployed nuclear weapons to Britain for the first time in 15 years. Now, the United States has, through NATO, has nuclear weapons in Europe. That's been a longstanding thing since the Cold War. But this was given a lot of notoriety. The transponders weren't turned off. The Americans were sending the Russians a message, okay? What is that message? They're willing to escalate to the ultimate ring in the escalation ladder? What are they trying to say?
Well, if they're trying to escalate, then it's completely unnecessary because these are free-fall gravity bombs, most likely the B-61, 11, 12, maybe 13. So you would have to send an aircraft to fly over the target and then drop the bomb. It's very difficult to do that against Russian air defenses, especially now after they've had three and a half years to pretty much hone their skills. So I think it's unnecessary escalation, although it could be like opening the Pandora's box towards more the deployment of more advanced systems, such as, for instance, the MRBMs or medium range ballistic missiles, or even IRBMs, which are intermediate range up to 5,500 kilometers. So we could be heading to the 1980s. I think a lot of us remember the 1983 Able Archer exercise that nearly caused nuclear war. So we might see more of that in the future if NATO continues to deploy these nuclear weapons. Now, the U.S. has, I think, six countries in Europe that actually have nuclear weapons that were sent from the United States. That's Turkey, Italy, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, and now the U.K. So that's a lot. And it also shows that NATO will continue, and the United States, obviously, will continue to try to encircle Russia with these highly destructive weapons. So the B-61-13 has 340 kilotons of destructive power. That's around 16 or 17 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. So these weapons can only be used against population centers. Targeting the Russian military with this is not viable, unless you use air-launched missiles of some kind.
You know, Daniel, is Europe, with all the rhetoric that's going on, you know, preparing for war with Russia, you know, one could say this is a bluff, but I've been saying ever since 2014, when all of this started, the Russians don't bluff, they act. Does the West understand that?
Yes, the West understands it. It's beginning to understand it. But Europe is deeply divided geographically and politically. And the centrist parties, from the Social Democrats to the neoliberals, are being beaten really badly in the polls because of their pro-war stance. They are just getting creamed. And Europe is in no shape to launch any kind of war against Russia. There's just too many cross currents, too many conflicts of interest. The Baltics, Poland, et cetera, have one point of view. Germany has another point of view. France, a third, et cetera, et cetera. If there was ever any exchange of fire, the EU would rapidly fall apart, I am convinced. But that is why they're so panicked over the prospect of Russian advances, because they know they really have no way of responding. Look, they thought they were facing a very simple problem back when this war began. The U.S. would send in arms, Russia would collapse, everyone would have a fantastic victory party, and the whole story would end very, very happily. That's not happening. It's ending on a very different note, and the Europeans are increasingly panicked as to what this all means.
Well, you know, is this because of Russia's superiority or because of just the complete ineffective, even corrupt behavior of the West? I mean, you know, with Russia, it's always the Keystone Cops or it's 007. They never can make up their mind.
It's Paul Kennedy's phrase, imperial overstretch. I mean, they just bit off more than they can chew. It was a bridge too far. The U.S.-backed coup in February 2014 was a disaster. It tore the country apart in ways that America didn't expect. And now it has no clear way of responding as the situation has continued to deteriorate.
All right, we're almost out of time. So first you, Daniel, do you trust the man that cheats at golf?
I don't trust Trump to do anything except surprise us 24/7.
Okay, let's go to London. Your vote. Do you trust the man that cheats at golf, particularly if he's the most powerful man in the world?
Oh, absolutely not, especially a New York shyster for that matter.
Okay, that was the best answer of the year so far. Okay, Drago, your thoughts on the president of the United States cheating at his own golf game. Apparently, he does it a lot. Go ahead.
I don't play golf, but I don't trust Trump. That's all I can say. And it's difficult to beat my predecessors in these answers.
Well, obviously I'm trying to introduce some levity into the program, but I think it's a very good metaphor for what's going on. I mean, if you can't get what you want through legal means, moral means, I mean, you know, for me, you know, when Trump visited Scotland, he was asked about Gaza and he just could care less. I mean, you know, a lot of people are dying. You know, there's starvation there. And then he goes out and cheats. I mean, I think that's a metaphor for our times. Maybe I'm taking it too personally. Nonetheless, gentlemen, we have run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Washington, London, and in Serbia. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.